So when John was in Afghan, we used to send something called blueies, letters back and forth. He doesn't say my name, he just says nice bum. Just a small letter to let you know how I'm feeling, because I'm usually a knob on the blower. I don't know why I'm like it. I do want a nice chat with you, but something is stopping me. The shrink said we might get like that. I don't mean to. It's just my head playing up. This place will never break me. It hasn't even come close. It just gave me a new perspective on life, which is good, I think. Had some bad news this morning. We lost another lad to an IED. I saw the explosion from the Sangha and it made me feel so sick that I almost cried. He was young and only been talking to me days before. He died instantly, I hoped. I've said about 3 prayers up to now to make sure I stay safe, not for my benefit, but for yours. Because you might not admit it, but you need me to look after you, don't you? I can't wait until I'm from this hell on earth place and safe at home with you. But at the moment, I'm trying to not think of home so much because it's making the time go slower. I love you so much. You're my world. Head up, okay? I love you.
That bloke had his skin blown off. Gone. Poor fucker.
John Screen, guardsman in the Welsh Guards, with his wife Lucy. April 2009, the Welsh Guards were deployed to Helmand Province, Afghanistan, on a 6-month tour.
I haven't really told my story since I left the military and what happened. Don't get me wrong, I've questioned why I'm doing it, but I think it's time for me to sort of come out and sort of say what happened to us during that tour.
Happening, boys. Let's go.
I was a young boy going to Afghanistan. I was going over there thinking it was going to be like Iraq, and I was wrong, massively wrong.
It would be known as the British Army's bloodiest summer in over half a century. Soldiers in gun battles.
Every day, every hour, every second was survival.
It was fucking chaos. I loved it. There's no fucking better feeling.
Fucking get in there!
It's like cocaine or heroin mixed into one. Fucking, it is incredible.
That tumultuous period, the tragedy aside, it was the most defining moment of my military career.
It's not just soldiers who were fighting. There's a battle being fought at home as well.
6 months is hell. It is hell. There's nothing you can do, really. Just hope and pray.
I still don't understand that sense of loyalty towards men who aren't your family.
This is an untold story.
How do you feel about being here?
It's a big leap of faith doing this.
For me, it's closure.
Fuck!
Telling the story of what it was like being on the ground in 2009.
In the words of 10 soldiers and their families from Support Company 1st Battalion Welsh Guards.
Nobody came back the same person as they went. Nobody did.
That was a fucking proper tour. That was war. But we got through it. Just.
Helmand, tour of duty. Gliding over misty countryside, where green fields and hedgerows slope gently down to a river winding through the valley, Gavin Evans, a sergeant in the Welsh Guards, with thinning red hair and a greying beard.
In Welsh Guards, we're all cut from the same cloth, if you like. A big family. We know what our upbringings have been like. We know what our surrounding areas are like. And we just look out for each other.
John Screen, a burly man with a brown beard and pierced earlobe.
As a kid, I wanted to be Robocop or cowboy. I might have done both. I don't know. Killed bad guys. I was into everything. Fighting, football, I set Tesco's on fire as a kid. Why, I don't know. But I could feel myself going down a bit of a slippery slope. I didn't want to go down. I got the bus to Newport, into the recruiting office, said, I want to join the Welsh Guards. And that, the rest is history, as they say.
I grew up on Barry Island. There's a few boys I was in school with that had gone to the Welsh Guards. So I thought, I'll jump on that wagon too.
And this is a letter to say, congratulations on joining the Welsh Guards. But remember, the man in front is always a guardsman, and a Welsh one at that. Nice.
Everybody, when he first started in the army, everybody used to call him Mammy's Little Soldier. Didn't they? Mammy's Little Soldier.
Don't put that on her.
When I left for Afghan, I was leaving behind mother, father and a fiancé.
It was Easter before you went and you proposed. I think I bullied him into it, to be honest.
Told you that, didn't I?
I'm not a very patient person. He went downstairs to go make me some breakfast. He was in my mother and father's house. And I went and checked his pockets to see if he had anything.
Did you? You fucker, I didn't know. Did you really?
So I found the rim box in his pockets.
Fucker, I didn't know her.
Sorry.
You shithead. A month or so later, I was in the desert, man.
Sitting on a footstool in a white-painted room with blinds on the window, Gavin Evans opens a playlist on his phone.
Right, I've always liked Foo Fighters. That's a memory for me, that song. Every time I hear that, I think of Afghanistan. Every time.
Spring 2009, 8 years into the war in Afghanistan.
The Taliban have increased their presence around the country. A long and bloody summer is expected.
Day one, 7th of April 2009, the Welsh Guards deploy to the epicentre of the conflict. A division of mostly young white men in khaki camouflage fatigues carry their backpacks down from a plane. Dale Leach, a guardsman with tattoos on his arms and neck.
Getting off the plane, so I've been punched in the face. The heat's horrendous. And you've got all your kit on, you've got your body armour on.
It was fucking boiling. It's stupid o'clock in the morning. I thought, oh my God, this is too much. I don't like warm weather, see, I prefer to be cold. I thought, this is fucking shit.
It was exciting. It's really exciting to go out there. I was loving it.
Camp Bastion.
Landing Camp Bastion. You have a few days to yourself just to acclimatise the heat. You sunbathe. You're abroad on holiday with your mates.
I went on that tour with some of the best boys that I would ever meet.
Got taken to the accommodation. There's a pizza over there. You know, Bastion was a fucking holiday camp. We were just preparing for what was going to come. When that was going to come, we didn't know. But yeah, it was quite surreal, to be honest.
Once deployed, the Welsh Guards are expected to be the British Army's main battle group in the notorious Helmand province. A tough 6 months is ahead of them.
My rank was Major, and I was the Principal Planning and Operations Officer. And given that the plans that we were conceiving meant that soldiers under our command were putting themselves in harm's way, was a massive responsibility. The structure of our battalion was right at the very top, commanding officer Rupert Thornley. He's the figurehead of the battalion. He's the leader of the battalion. It has an inspirational role. And then below Rupert, headed up by me, the battalion second in command, 5 rifle companies. And then you'd have the support company, which underneath that you'd have recce platoon and the fire support groups, FSGs.
A group photo of Fire Support Group 2, Colour Sergeant Jonathan Jenkinson, JJ.
I was in charge of FSG 2, and we were all very, very close.
I first met Dale in 2003, before we deployed to Iraq. It's almost like a yin and yang type thing. Like, he's the mischievous, quiet, but he gets away with murder, whereas I'm the very sort of, like, strict, follow the rules, I'll probably grass him in every now and again when he breaks those rules.
I think we were all ready for it because we're such a close bunch. So you know, whatever anything happens, your mates there, you've got your mates back, they've got your back.
I loved absolutely everything about the military, the smell, like the clothes, the uniform. I was looking forward to going. I wasn't scared, I wasn't worried. We were all going together and I was all in.
Lance Corporal Geraint Hillard, then John Screen.
My platoon was called the Reconnaissance Platoon. We were also part of the support company. That platoon, Recce, was fucking incredible. Absolutely incredible.
To get into Recce platoon, there was a selection process. So to get into that, it was like a real sense of achievement. The platoon sergeant was Steve Peters. He's a great leader.
In 2009, I was 27 years old. As a platoon sergeant, I needed to be the role model. When we were about to deploy, I remember I stood up and I said to them all, I said, I promise everyone around this table that we will all come back once this is finished. I think I put a lot of pressure on myself by saying that, but I think it was the right thing to say at the time because it showed that we were doing it together and we were going to support each other from day one to the last day of the tour.
We knew it was going to be challenging. And for me, being in charge, it was just about making sure that all my men come back in one piece.
A map shows Helmand Province in the south of Afghanistan.
The whole battalion was deployed in different locations across Helmand. That's 600 plus soldiers. The Green Zone was in the centre of our area of operation. And support company would have been in this Green Zone. Our mission was to get rid of a force that we considered evil, the Taliban, and to make sure they could not influence terrorist operations in the wider world.
Outside Camp Bastion, there was a number of patrol bases. We went to Silab. First couple of contacts were actually them engaging us in the base.
The first time you get shot at or watered, that changes your whole perspective on everything. You're thinking this is going to be like a walk in the park, but the realities of it soon kicked in. I didn't think it was going to be as intense as it was.
Guardsman James Barber.
I think my first firefight was alongside Barber, and I almost deafened him with my rifle because it was quite a tasty firefight.
There was fucking every.
It was just fucking carnage, and I loved it.
And then we started to go out on patrols.
We would push out forward, secure ground from the Taliban, and then maintain and hold that area.
The first patrol I was on, I think we were in contact for 19 hours. We were out there for ages. You're out in the open, and because obviously you're in these jackals, and you're just sitting ducks. It was just mayhem. And you had to be on the ball, otherwise you're going to have a lot of casualties.
28th of April, 2009.
A Welsh soldier has been killed in a blast in Afghanistan while on foot patrol in Helmand Province. 29-year-old Lance Sergeant Toby Fasfus from 1st Battalion Welsh Guards had already served in Bosnia and Iraq.
Toby Fasfus wasn't with us. He wasn't down in Silab, but anybody from support company who got killed up there, it affected everybody quite severely.
Hi, darling. Just a few lines to let you know that I'm OK. Can't believe that one of our boys has died already. Toby Fasfus, a real good friend of mine, only in his 20s. Have had a little cry, but must get on with it now for the sake of my own safety and the boys' safety. I love you loads, and I'm missing you all so much. It hurts me inside. Have the pictures of you and the kids up by my side and say hello to them every morning and before I go to bed. Keep strong, love, for the sake of the kids. Tell them that Daddy loves them and can't wait to see them. Always in my thoughts, forever yours, Jay.
Jess Jenkinson.
When we heard that news, the first Welsh Guardsman to get killed, that was a real shock. So, you know, we were sort of, every day then, we were, every time we went out, it was getting harder and harder because you knew probably you'd be involved in some kind of contact.
British troops in Afghanistan no longer face a structured Taliban army across a conventional battlefield. For Taliban, tactics have changed with devastating consequence.
It's a nasty place. It was a difficult place to operate. It wasn't enemy here, friendly forces here, let's meet in the middle and have a big bust-up. It was far more complicated.
You don't know who's who because the enemy dress like locals anyway. They all dress the same.
A male could be cropping his crops. He'd say, salam alaikum to us on the way out. We'd say, walaikum salam back to him. On the way back from our patrol, the same guy, he could be on top of his roof shooting at us, and you're like, fucking really? What the fuck are you doing?
But our major problem were the improvised explosive device. So it was the Taliban's main weapon.
An explosion in a road.
Each area would be split into different tracks and roads, sort of grid system. So if you were the enemy trying to work out where the British forces were going to go, you could be pretty much sure they're going to turn at one of these junctions. So they could put an IED there. Every time you got to a junction, you'd have to get out, you'd have to bomb up, which is a man with a metal detector at the front trying to find these IEDs. They would clear the area, get back in the vehicles, move on. It terrified us. You know, every step could have been, you know, a step into oblivion.
The bombing is, for me, this is the stuff I like most. It is fucking hideous. The noise of it, fucking hell. Oh, like a fucking horrible beeping noise. If I get a reading, I'd have to go my belly, prod, find the fucking size of the device. It is fucking scary. You're literally face to face with the device, and who's to know that that device isn't on a command wire that could fucking blow off in your face.
Day 66, 12th of June 2009. Support company had been ordered to secure a series of supply routes to isolated bases.
On that particular day, there was a large resupply coming in. So my fire support group were tasked to go out and secure the route.
Gavin Evans draws a map.
We had Silab, which where our base was. We had a few compounds here. And then where the track comes round, you had a thing what we called Green One. It was like a vulnerable point because you got no option other than going over Green One to come to Silab. Orders were to go up and onto the high ground overlooking Green One. The convoy then would be heading from Bastion down this track. We'd put ourselves up onto high ground, ensuring that the convoy was going to be safe coming in.
A small armoured vehicle.
That morning, we went out in three vehicles.
Geraint wasn't supposed to come out because we were only supposed to have a certain amount in a jackal.
I was one of the team medics, and if anything happened, then I wanted to give them the best chance to get back to camp if anything happened and get them home. So we managed to convince JJ to let me come out.
When we got to the high ground overlooking Green One, JJ gathered us all for a brief. He told us exactly where he wanted us to go.
I'd sent Gav one way because he's got the sniper asset with him. And then I sent Dale's vehicle off to the sort of off to the left. He sort of swung out off just literally in front of me about, it must have been about 40 metres. The vehicle just went into the air. Huge explosion.
From a black screen, fading slowly in on Dale with his eyes downcast.
When that vehicle goes up and you see the guys in the air, just flying in the air, it's horrendous. Literally in the air in front of you like rag dolls.
This is if everything stops.
This is if everything goes into slow motion. I looked above the smoke and all I could see was three people circling in the air. You can hear everything falling on the ground. Gravel. And then all of a sudden, the boys.
There's a command there, you know, you've got multiple things that are going through your head. The Taliban, they started opening up on us, firing at us. There was fuel, ammunition everywhere as well, so it was sort of chaos. The casualties are dying in front of us. It's carnage, really.
I was the closest to Dale's vehicle. What we seen was fucking horrific. It was, Dale was missing a leg straight away. He was unconscious. Nothing coming from him. Just blood. Geraint was screaming in pain. So we were trying to deal with the casualties, missing legs and so on. And then them fuckers firing at us as well.
Fortunately, we were able to bring artillery down onto their positions.
Where they were firing from just obliterated it. Firing stopped them for a small while. We were just applying tourniquets to Dale's leg, because, like I said, his leg wasn't there, so it was from his groin area down, had gone. I couldn't even see where it had gone. Geraint, all his face was smashed with body armour plate to come through, missing his teeth.
A helicopter descends through smoke.
The American MERT team came in. Make sure there was no IEDs there for them to land on. They came in, landed. They gave me the thumbs up, it took them, and that was the last we seen of them.
It flies away.
I was so tired, I was so drained, I was so emotionally drained.
Dale's leg was... must have been about 50, 60 metres away, blown off. And I said to Gav, I said, listen, Gav, we're not leaving this place without Leach's leg. And he looked at me and went, are you serious? We're basically taking fire here and you want us to go and get his leg? And again, this is me being the commander. I said, listen, we're not leaving this location without his leg.
He's like, fuck, are you real, Jay? I said, it could be IEDs everywhere. I said, fuck, we're not looking for that, but...
It was just a conscious decision, I thought, at the time in my head. I thought, I'm not going to leave a member of my guy's body part here for them to potentially, I don't know, anyone could have taken it, anyone could have got hold of it. You know, I wasn't going to leave someone's bits all over the desert. It just wasn't the right thing to do.
To hear them words shocked me. But JJ's the person I looked up to the most. He was our platoon commander, so it had to be done. So me and Viper, we bombed again, safe route. As I looked over into this little bit of dead ground, I could see Dale's leg still had his boot on. It was fucking horrific. It was fucking terrible. I said, fuck, I can't do it. I said, I can't pick that up. I said, I can't fucking do it. So Viper, being the butcher from the farm, he said, fuck it, out the way, give it a... Picked it up.
We wrapped it in a poncho and then put it in the back of one of the vehicles, got it back to base.
It was a case on then of all the boys sat up against the wall crying, thinking they've lost Dale, lost Geraint, thinking they're dead. I thought they were dead. I said, listen, I know you're upset. I said, I'm upset. We've got to go back out, boys. We've got to achieve our aim. We've got to get the resupply in of rations and ammunition, or none of us are going to fucking survive. You go out there, anything fucking moves, after what they just done to your friends, you make sure you sort them out. And they did. They were good boys.
Obviously, we managed to get them out alive, which we're really thankful for. These are your men. These are your lads. That you've trained with, you know, you've done everything with. I felt absolutely devastated.
JJ didn't want anybody to get hurt. He's always worrying about people below him. But people are going to get hurt. But I think that's just war.
A seaside town and a fun fair under a cloudy sky. Dale Leach,
They flew me home. They put me in an induced coma. So I was in that 6 weeks, I think I was in that. I can't remember being in that hospital.
Dale climbs out of his car and hops to the back door, while Garen gets out on the passenger side.
I ended up with 22 injuries. I'd broken my back in 4 places. I'd broken my pelvis in 3 places. I had 2 head injuries. Didn't originally lose my leg until afterwards.
Anyway, you're right. When they brought me out of the coma in military hospital, I saw Gary, and I think he came over to my room. Will he come in? He said, "Fucking hell, mate! Look at the fucking stay on us." And then we went through the rehab together as well. Then
we were good friends before, but I think this injury has brought us closer because I can't always explain what I'm thinking or feeling or what it's been like, and he's the only other person that does get it. But one of the hardest things for me was the rest of the FSG stayed there. The rest of the FSG had to carry on doing their job. And we couldn't do it. We couldn't help. We weren't there. So leaving them there on the ground and us being flown back to the UK was really hard because I didn't want to leave. I felt like I'd let them down.
19th of June.
British troops are fighting a war in the south of Afghanistan that is getting more intense by the month.
A soldier who was injured in Afghanistan at the weekend and later died in hospital in Birmingham has been named. He was 26-year-old Lieutenant Mark Everson of the 1st Battalion Welsh Guards. He was shot while leading a patrol in Helmand province, where he was serving as a...
A soldier from Surrey, killed in Afghanistan, has been described by his widow as a devoted father. Major Sean Birchall from Guildford died in an explosion in Helmand province. His death takes the number of British service personnel killed to 169.
25th of June. The Welsh Guards are among 3,000 international troops deployed on Operation Panther's Claw.
Good evening. Welcome to the BBC News at 6. British forces are involved in a major land offensive in the Afghan province of Helmand in an effort to drive back the Taliban insurgency.
From early light, hundreds of troops moved into position. The main thrust in Operation Panther Claw.
From a brigade and battle group perspective, it was the biggest operation that we were involved in. And yeah, from my personal perspective, it was the biggest thing I'd ever planned and executed.
Troops are working to secure the Shalimand Canal, a key crossing point used by the Taliban to transport fighters and weapons.
We had to manoeuvre these troops to basically get up to the Shalimand Canal. And at the bottom of it was a place called Shari Anja, which was the sort of the first stepping stone for the battle group to start their clearance of the Shalimand Canal. There were these various junctions on the Shalimand Canal, which were road junctions, and the idea was to seize and hold those junctions and, in theory, stop the Taliban from leaking away from this big push that was coming from the east.
The British Army and its men are now being tested to the limits. Every step, every journey, runs the risk of death from roadside bombs.
Our job was to get up as far as possible and then take over crossing point one.
Sergeant Stephen Peters.
It was a massive area for the battle group to clear.
Going up the canal, I can remember that quite vividly. Got all these vehicles, all these troops, and going up this canal, you got compounds on the left-hand side. Over the other side of the water, then it's pretty much the same with compounds. You know, so we had to go through certain places to make sure it was safe, etc. So we'd send people forward, they'd secure that area, and then the next section or platoon would move forward. It was chaotic. All we seemed to do was get contacted. It was non-stop.
The intensity was hard. Every day, a shooting, an IED strike, casualties.
From like the offset, it's just like door-to-door fighting. Going from compound to compound, and then you get contact from the left and contact from the right. You've basically just like stirred up a hornet's nest.
Soldiers fire their rifles over a crumbling wall.
After the first 3 or 4 days of Panther's Claw, Wrecking Platoon moved into a compound to reconfigure themselves. It was a part of the battle where the battle group was stretched regards to the ground it was covering. We started to realise that, you know, this is going to be a hard-fought battle.
Steve brought us all in together, I think. He wouldn't ask you to do anything unless he would do it himself. Steve would lead patrols. Steve would, you know, jump on the machine gun with us. He would do everything with us. Steve was brilliant.
The Welsh Guardsman on patrol.
At the time, our FSG, because what he'd been through the first couple of days with Panther's Claw was a bit crazy. We had to have a secure place to stay for the night, if you like. We couldn't just stay on the canal. It's just too dangerous. So we took over compound 18. We could be moving in the morning. We didn't know. It was a case of whatever they wanted, or Lieutenant Colonel Thornlow. If he wanted us to move, we would have moved.
29th of June, Recce Platoon are ordered to advance north up the canal in armoured convoy.
I remember that day, you know, like, even today, like 16 years later. It's something which I haven't really talked about or haven't talked to other people about and haven't processed properly in my head still. I probably won't talk about it ever again, but it will help me feel more comfortable about things that I went through and we all went through.
We were informed over the net that the Wrecking Platoon needed to push forward a few kilometres to enable the spear of the battle group to move forward. Three Viking vehicles arrived to pick us up. And a Viking vehicle is a tracked vehicle with a cab at the front and a cab at the rear.
It's basically like a square tin with no windows, one hole in the roof just for top cover and one door at the back. So it's like a sardine tin. It's like a fucking metal coffin. They're supposed to be amphibious and watertight. Yeah, roger that. You wish it was.
James Barber laughs.
There was like 7 or 8 of us in the Viking. I was like third away from the door, squeezed in there. Kit all over us, GPMG over my lap, fucking day sacks night in there. And we set off.
I was in the second vehicle. You had the road, you had a sheer drop, which was the main canal that ran south to north.
The Taliban used to dig away sides of the road, and it was only a thin track next to the canal, and did that for vehicles to fall in. And then somebody said something like, fuck, we'd be fucked now if we had a contact or if anything happened. And we all laughed it off. Ah, fuck, it'd be all right.
20, 30 minutes up the road. The front vehicle manoeuvred round an obstacle.
And then I think I was like, oh, fucking how long is this? I ain't fucking sitting here. Like, I'm just crammed in this little fucking, like, sardine can.
And then the ground started to crumble away. The riverbank started to collapse.
And next thing I remember is just fucking, like, flying forward, smacking my face on the radio unit in front of me. So I've kind of, like, done a front flip, upside down on the opposite side. And then all this kit just fucking piling on me, and I'm pinned down in the corner, pitch black. And then just felt this fucking water. Just feel this cold water. I could feel it getting to, you know, to your nose there, and then you're breathing through your mouth, and then it covers your mouth because I'm upside down. That's the point where I thought, fuck. Like, fucking hell. And that's when you start to get scared. That's when I was fucking worried.
All I could hear over the net was shouting, swearing and screaming. And when I looked back, the rear vehicle had flipped on its right-hand side, rolled down the bank, the rear was fully submerged by the tracks.
James rubs his face.
It's that, like, dread of, like, you know what's happening, but you can't do anything about it. See, I remember, like, putting my hand up to try and fucking pull out, and I grabbed somebody's hand, and I was, like, fucking holding it, and their hand, like, they let go of my hand. And then that's... that time then, I thought, oh, fuck it, why not? And it's, that's it, it's over, like, you know?
He nods. Stephen Peters.
Thinking where the enemy was just went out the window. We all jumped in just trying to... It sounds stupid now, push the machine. This thing's tons and tons. It wasn't moving. Guys were swimming under the water, and you could see through the glass that the water hadn't reached the ceiling yet. We're all going under the water, pulling this lever, and it wouldn't budge. And I always remember I could see my really, really close friend, Sergeant Young, inside, screaming. He's trapped, he's drowning.
And then it's weird, like, I've gone from being really scared and flapping to being calm and just, like, breathe the water in. In my head, I kind of think that I accepted what was happening. Like, I'd accepted that, fuck it, that's it, done.
He blinks and his eyes glisten as he looks away.
You want to pause anything?
Yeah.
He opens a water bottle.
Ooh. I remember the smell of it. I can smell the smell and remember the taste, if that makes sense. Like, even now, like, 16 years later, I know what it smells like and tastes like and feels like.
James rubs his face, blinks and nods to the interviewer. A photo taken from high overhead shows the upside-down Viking in the canal and other vehicles along the bank.
It was pretty much outside our compound that happened. The Viking was in the water, there was equipment, there was people. There was a few members still stuck within the Viking. James Barber was one of them.
We know there's Taliban 100 metres, 200 metres from us. So all I'm thinking is they are going to ambush us. And also knowing that all my soldiers, friends, brothers are drowning to death. And I can't do anything about it.
We didn't care what was happening around us. All we wanted to concentrate on was get an envoy safe.
Eventually, I don't know whether someone was looking down on us that day or the power of the current moved something, the door opened. I remember the first two or three blokes sort of stumbled out, coughing, screaming, but then... But the rest of the men who were in there, they just floated out. No life.
Platoon members in a photo.
Stephen Peters, there is boys at the end of the day. He did look broken. Because he's worrying about his boys, he's worrying if they're going to be okay, worrying if they're going to survive.
I had hold of Garson Biggs. When I looked at his face, his tongue was out of his mouth, virtually touching his earlobe. His eyes were wide open, but there was no life in them. So I was carrying out mouth-to-mouth chest compressions. It felt like a lifetime. But thank God, he came around. And then I had to move on to... the next casualty, and this was Garson Thomas 08. This must have been 8 to 10 minutes he'd been submerged in that. The mess. He was wrapped and crushed by kit and equipment. We got him out, and we cracked on. As you're trained with the initial first aid, the medic and blokes were punching his chest, his heart. We're doing everything to get him back. and he came back.
Stephen takes a deep breath.
So after a period, we identified everyone. Barbara was, like, paralysed from the waist down. Couldn't feel any of his legs. It was process. We need to casuvac these guys off the ground.
Lack of proper memory is being on the floor, and then it was quite surreal. Like, he's lay there looking up, and you can see the Black Hawk come around.
The helicopter passes over the canal.
I thought it was quite cool, like, but...
29th of June 2009. Footage from the Black Hawk as it descends past the canal towards a ploughed field, where soldiers stand gathered around a stretcher. Crewmen have the side door open and dust swirls as the helicopter touches down.
I remember all the lads carrying me on to the Black Hawk on the stretcher. I mean, those people I owe my life to. The people who pulled me out of there and put me onto that Black Hawk, I wouldn't be here if they didn't do that.
Soldiers climb quickly on board in single file, some with their arms in slings, and the helicopter takes off.
So, like, rest of my life, I owe my life to them.
Descending towards the base.
Went straight into intensive care, where I was put on a spinal board. And because of the shit that was in the water, that affected my liver, my kidneys, my pancreas, my stomach. Because of the injury I had to my back, I learned to walk again, which took about 6 months.
Sitting with a baby in a pram.
Yeah, I've struggled, 100%. Not going to lie, a lot. You know, I find it hard to come to terms with lots of different things that have happened. There's been times when, you know, I've fucking just drunk, fucking just got pissed all the time, because that was my way of dealing with it. But it's only, like, over time, that's when I've learned that that's not the best way to deal with things. This is the first time I've spoke about everything fully, which I think I needed to do. In the long term, you can't get over things unless you talk about them. But there's still stuff that only time can heal, I think.
A photo including James and Stephen.
As a platoon sergeant, I needed to be the person who led from the front. And if I showed emotion, if I showed that I was broken, it would flood down to my guardsmen. I had to park what had happened and you're ready for your next set of orders. And the next set of orders was, we'd push up about half a kilometre to an old compound. It looked like a mosque, there's a few prayer mats. We'd sit there for a few days just to get ourselves re-orbited to then carry on with the battle.
Major Andrew Speed plays a video of Lieutenant Colonel Rupert Thornlow, MBE.
This is a challenging mission, and all of us in our own minds have prepared ourselves for the potential consequences of that. It's a mission that we believe in. It's a mission we're proud to be doing. And we know that as soldiers, at the end of the day, it's our job on behalf of the people of the UK to come out and face these dangers so that the people back home don't have to.
I haven't heard Rupert's voice for a long time, so that was very emotional. I mean, the last time I probably heard it was on a radio set in a very hot and dusty operations room as he was moving up the Shamlan Canal to get his boots on the ground, to lead by example. That's the job of the leader, to inspire.
Day 85, 1st of June 2009, 2 kilometres south of Recce Patrol's position, Commanding Officer Rupert Thornlow joins a convoy of vehicles on a resupply mission. Stephen Peters.
We first heard the explosion.
Black smoke in the distance.
And then it came over the net, sun rays down. And that meant the commanding officer had been killed in action.
That was our worst case scenario, which, to be honest, hit everyone for six.
Lieutenant Colonel Rupert Thornlow is the most senior British Army officer to be killed in action since the Falklands War. 18-year-old trooper Joshua Hammond was also killed in the same explosion.
I went over to the watchkeeper for the day, the guy keeping track of operations, and I said, you know, are we certain about this? Double check that. Said, no, it is the commanding officer. There was one captain was dealing with the situation with tears running down his face. Every life lost was a life we didn't want to lose. At the level that Rupert was at, had a bigger operational impact because he's the boss. That was probably the only moment where I felt a visceral desire for instant revenge.
For someone as vital and important to the battalion to get killed, just sent shockwaves through everybody, I think.
It really frightened me, like worried me, thinking, oh my God, he's...
Commanding officer.
Commanding, and he's been killed. I was thinking, oh my God, how bad is it out there?
The wrecking platoon started with 28. There was about 16 of us left now. And there was silence for 45 minutes. No one talked. No one had a fag. No one moved. The atmosphere was... It was eerie. We looked to our right. The Viking vehicle is upside down. Look left. The front line of the Taliban is 100 metres away. Within the compound, you've got broken Welsh guardsmen. One of them was shaking and rocking backwards and forwards. Get me out of here. I want to go home.
Galvanised a lot of people because they just killed our boss. So they pissed the wrong people off. So that day, we had a bit of a payback, if you like.
Handheld footage in bright sunlight of guardsmen firing over a wall, then ducking for cover. A soldier wearing a flak jacket over his bare chest reloads his rifle. Others smile at the camera through a gap in the top of a wall. Major Andrew Speed sets a large green metal trunk down on a table. Opening the hinged lid, he takes out a folder and lays papers and photos out across the table.
I had to write and give a eulogy in front of 1,000 people for Rupert. To lose such a man while in operations is a considerable blow, but it is a blow that will not discourage us. He adored the Welsh Guards.
He takes a deep breath.
The regiment, the battalion, but especially his guardsmen.
Soldiers carrying a coffin which is draped with the Union flag.
Those Welsh guardsmen that were in camp on that day were there on parade and in lines either side of the plane as the coffin was marched down and up on into the Hercules. And literally as all that was happening, I was told the news that another soldier, Corporal Dane Nelson, had been killed. So I was standing in the dark on the airhead in Bastion, telling these Welsh guards that yet another one of their friends had been killed. And I think it was at that moment, on that airhead, talking to those soldiers, folding my little bit of paper away, somehow it's coming back to me, that I just thought, yeah, this is hardcore. This is a challenge. And we are really in the thick of it right now. And when's it going to stop?
A bald white man in fatigues walks down a hallway. Captain Darren Pridmore, UK Welfare Officer in the Welsh Guards.
All communications are switched off from theatre until that person, that next of kin, is told. The notification officer will knock on the door, and it's literally, I have the unenviable task to say that your loved one has been killed in action. And it is as almost as simple as that.
Lance Corporal Dane Nelson killed in action on the 5th of July.
My son, Dane, he was a lovable rogue full of beans. Life and soul of the party, everybody loved him. He was mischievous, always in trouble. Always in trouble.
His mother, Deborah Morris.
5th of July... We'd been to see a friend of ours in hospital. We got back here 9 o'clock. Rowan and my daughter. She said, There's two men standing at the door. And I said, well, don't let them in. And they carried on knocking, and then they came in. And he said, we've come to tell you that at 4 o'clock Afghanistan time. And I said, no, I said, you've got it wrong. You've got it wrong. I said, no. I said, you need to go. And he said, no. He said, we do a thorough investigation to make sure that we don't make mistakes on this type of thing. And I said, well, you have on this occasion, you've made a big mistake. And he said, no. I said, I'm very sorry, we haven't. And to be honest, after that, I don't really remember much more.
She blinks back tears and swallows.
Dane was killed by an IED. It's only what you see on the telly, really, that you get an idea of what one is. But no, it doesn't bear thinking about. Before he was repatriated back to the UK, one of those warrant officers sat with him every second. They took shifts and he was not left alone. And then they both escorted him and the others on the plane all the way home. And that brought so much comfort, knowing that he wasn't just left in a room on his own, that somebody was there with him until he was back with his family.
We followed up after Dane's family had been told. It was important that they knew that we were part of that family, and we knew him, and I knew him well, and I'd served with him.
Do you get emotional about it, or have you cried all your tears?
No, I still cry a lot, but I try to hold it together for, and it's generally speaking when I'm by myself.
What happens then?
Well, it's like a sledgehammer hits you. All of a sudden, you can go for absolutely ages, and it'll just, something will spark it. And then your stomach just drops, and it's just, it's like a sledgehammer.
Sitting with somebody who's, you know, just lost their husband or their son, you know, stays with you. It's really raw. Does
Darren nods and looks down, emotional.
Yeah, it does play on you. It does play on you.
Dale Leach pulls on goggles, sits on the edge of an indoor pool and starts swimming. Among the tattoos on his back is Dane Elson, FSG3.
British and American forces in Afghanistan are enduring one of the bloodiest weeks since they were deployed 8 years ago. And the UK's Defence Secretary warned that there would be more British casualties in Afghanistan.
Another British soldier has died in Afghanistan, the seventh in a week. But the Defence Secretary insists that troops are making progress there, though he warns success will require more sacrifice.
The big media sort of piece, it sensationalised, you know, real grief. All these things didn't really capture for me what these families were genuinely, genuinely going through.
I'd be watching the news all the time, all day, night. Up, sleeping on SETI, watching Sky News. It took over my life, like. And my husband used to say, and everybody else, it's not the news you want to be watching, it's a knock on the door that, you know, you've got to worry about, isn't it?
All we was hearing was how many people was getting killed, and they just seemed to be every single day. I can remember the radio being on, it was like this day was going on, there'd be more. And my legs would just go weak in work, thinking, oh, my God. If every rang me, I'd have to drop everything and run. And I'd have arguments with my bosses about stuff because they'd be, like, screaming at me, get off your phone. I was like, no, sorry. This is more important. I didn't care about anything else at the time other than, you know, speaking to him because I didn't know when I'd get to speak to him again. At that point, when so many were killed, I thought, shit. He might not come back.
Lucy Screen. Day 135, 20th of August 2009. Despite heavy casualties, Operation Panther's Claw has succeeded in taking all target territory.
Phase one of Britain's bloodiest battle in Afghanistan is over. 11 British soldiers have died, but the Prime Minister says they didn't die in vain.
So, Panther's Claw, we ended up where we needed to be, which is to clear that area to the east of the Shyamalan of the Taliban.
3,000 troops took part in all in one of the biggest British offensives in Helmand so far.
We cleared it, we occupied it, we started patrolling in it, we had a presence in it. So that element of the plan was a success.
What we've done is push back the Taliban, start to break that chain of terror that links the mountains of Afghanistan and Pakistan to the streets of Britain.
Colour Sergeant Jonathan Jenkinson.
I wasn't there for the end of Panther's Claw. I was hit by an artillery drone in the back. I think if it had hit me, probably in the neck, it would have killed me.
I do remember the day that I got the call. My mobile rang and I answered it, and it was your welfare chap, Jiffy.
Jiffy Myers, yeah.
Saying the words you never want to hear. Now, I don't want you to worry, but... And I was like, what? And he just said, you know, Jay's been flown home. He's been involved in an accident. I was obviously absolutely devastated, but a part of me inside was... Well, he's alive and he's coming home and he's going to be OK. And I kind of thought that I could put that aside now and sort of that's one less worry. He's back. So to have you then get yourself, like, really fit and healthy and go back because your men out there were so important to you is really hard for a civilian person to even comprehend. I found
you
it
didn't
really
understand
hard.
It, did
no,
you?
I didn't. And I still, if no, you ask me now, no. I still don't understand that sense of loyalty towards men who aren't your flesh and blood versus, you know, your wife and children back here and what about
and you did
us?
Say, and you did say that.
Yeah,
didn't
I did.
You, loads of times.
I did.
She was like, I wouldn't say begging me not
I
to.
I did beg you. I did beg you. I did beg you not to go back because I just... I'd been to the hospital, I'd seen real reality, I'd been to Dane's funeral, so it made it almost worse. And, you know, that day taking you with the children down to Bryce Norton and waving you off was probably the worst.
Everyone was crying.
Yeah, everyone was crying, yeah. I can remember you walking into that terminal and... thinking, I can't believe I'm actually leaving him. I cannot believe I'm taking you back so that you can get on a plane and go back from where you've come from, back to the danger and the perils that you were going to be facing.
Day 140, 25th of August 2009. Following Operation Panther's Claw, units from Support Company are tasked with holding the newly gained territory. Armed guardsmen at the side of a road. Go.
By this point, this northern spot up here became a particular focus because there was a greater concentration of Taliban in that particular area. It was one of those really high threat areas where we were always expecting something bad to happen. The enemy was determined, dedicated, fervent, suicidal, prosecuted what they wanted to do to the point of recklessness. Because they almost didn't seem to have a care for their own life. You know, religious dedication, the chance of eternal life in paradise was what motivated them.
At that stage, day one go by where we would either be again facing quite intense firefights, fucking IED strikes, fucking pinned down. I was afraid quite a lot. It isn't like a sort of and afraid, like a civilian sort of afraid. Found fear out there differently because I didn't know where the next threat was going to come along. We're pushing fate every time we fucking stepped out, and that's the truth of the matter.
John Screen, then Stephen Peters.
At this point, we had interpreters out there, which was a massive asset on the battlefield because they'd used the ICOM scanner to scan the radio waves to pick up Taliban communication, gathering intelligence on the enemy or targets on the radio net. The interpreters out there, they'd be out on the ground for longer periods of time. So you're talking 8, 9 months, 12 months. And I built a strong relationship with one of the interpreters, Ahmed Popel. I got to know him pretty well, and he was telling me that he was looking forward to the end of the week because it was time for him to go home to see his young children, his family.
Day 158, 12th of September 2009. Recce platoon are chosen to lead an assault on a Taliban-held compound. Less than a month of the tour remains.
This was probably the last big mission for the Recce platoon. This specific night, we were tasked to carry out a strike on a specific building.
The snipers had gone out the night before, ready to route for us. It was all planned. It was all good. We knew what we had to do. We had to get into that compound and see what was in there.
Going into this patrol, pitch black, night vision. I was the sergeant, and the patrol was commanded by the platoon commander, Tom Spencer-Smith. We're patrolling through a high populated Taliban area, knowing it's the most dangerous kilometre square area in the world that was reported at the time. We called it IED Central.
Going down this sort of narrow corridor between these compounds, the walls, they must have been about 10 foot, 11 foot high. Going through. And we're all sort of clinging to the wall. We're walking right to the wall.
Between me and Tom Spencer-Smith, there was Ahmed.
And all of a sudden, the interpreter must have stepped off from the wall and stepped into the middle of this track. And fucking boom.
I come around. All I can remember was dust, pitch black, the smell of smoke, the smell of burnt flesh, and screaming. I was sat down with my legs in this massive crater. This device was definitely made and built to destroy an object the size of a vehicle. So I could see a dark object at the bottom of this crater. So I got my torch out and started looking. What I saw that morning, a human being is not designed to see what I saw, was Popel. I'd realised that his body was cut in half. There was nothing left from his belly button down. So I'm thinking, how can I save this person?
Steve's in the crater with him, fucking giving him mouth to mouth. Like, is fucking incredible. Absolutely incredible.
And then I just started picking up the body parts and placing them on the stretcher. But as I was doing that, I realised that the platoon commander, Tom Spencer-Smith, was injured. He had blood coming down his neck. So we've had a catastrophic attack and casualty. We've got half the platoon suffering from extreme shock. We now need to move forward through tens, 20, 30 IEDs hidden in the ground. So the only way we could get out of there safely was to form a chain. And then we were literally moving forward 5 metres, stop, clear a safe route, turn left, move 2 metres, stop, forward. And we had to do that for 500 metres. until we got onto the northern bank and we handed over the casualties.
Ahmed Popal.
There was no life in him. There was nothing left of that human, of Ahmed. And all he wanted to do was to go home and see his family the next day. And people speak to me and say, you've been through all these battles and worked with soldiers and lost soldiers next to you. But because of the bond I had with this interpreter and what we had been through and the conversations that we had, it hit me really hard. And it's affected me a lot. I went from the gold-plated armoured warrior platoon sergeant on the ground, walked straight into my little compound where I was living, I dropped to my knees, and I just started crying and crying. And I was there for a good 45 minutes. It just couldn't stop. I wanted to punch, I wanted to scream. Shane then came in and put his arm around me and said, do you want me to take you off the ground? And I said no, because I didn't want to leave my position and leave my men with no commander. I was there to take them home. Looking back at that, I should have said yes. Because I was mentally scarred. But as I did back then, I gathered my thoughts. I took a big gulp. I filed it away in the part of my head that I'd deal with it at a later date. And then we moved on.
Guardsmen on patrol, then resting with the helmets off under some trees.
We were in a very bad place that last few weeks of the tour. But we got through it and we got to the end. We survived. That's probably the word I can say, we survived.
Soldiers board a helicopter.
The whole tour was about endurance and human endeavour. It's about soldiers sticking together. It's about brothers in arms. It's the story of soldiery. Guardsmen fighting alongside guardsmen. It's officers leading from the front.
The transport helicopter takes off into a blue sky.
Everyone at every level, everyone was doing their damnedest to get the job done, and it was, from a human perspective, was truly impressive.
A rifle aimed at the ground below.
And I was immensely proud of what we achieved. Not on a grand political scale, not even on a sort of strategic level, not even on an operational, but just survival and overcoming the obstacles that were put in front of them. Incredibly proud of everything we did.
Andrew Speed. Day 183, 7th of October 2009. By the end of the tour, the Welsh Guards battle group controlled twice the territory it had held at its start.
Home at last. The men of the 1st Battalion Welsh Guards landed back at RAF Price Norton.
It was on the news with them getting off the aeroplane. So I was watching it and I said, I can see him. Crying then.
Gavin Evans' mum, Wendy, chuckles.
Get a grip.
Jonathan Jenkinson.
Being with Gavin from the start of the tour, going through everything that we'd been through, just wanted to make sure that I was with him when he came back. To fly home with Gavin and a couple of the other guys that I'd been with, that was really important to me.
When you stepped off the bus?
Everyone ran.
Yeah, it was just a big sandwich of bodies. Yeah, just like pushed together, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Everyone wanted a piece of you, didn't they? So, yeah. Well, no, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
guardsmen receiving warm hugs.
Hello, son! Oh, I'm so glad you're home.
A photographer takes pictures while wives, partners, mothers and children gather round the bus, kissing the young men who are wearing green berets with their fatigues. Lucy Screen.
I saw the coach arrive, I was already in the car park waiting. But knowing John the way I do, I just sat in the car and waited for him. And if I had got all this, it just wouldn't have worked. So he just got in the car and was just... I think we did have a bit of a hug and a kiss.
Quiet, wasn't it? Strange going
on. Yeah. And I think it was part of that. We were both waiting for that, like, oh.
Relief.
Never come. Just never. Never come. I can remember I took a couple of weeks off work when he came back because I just didn't feel right at all. And, you know, even now, well, over the years, seeing the change in him, recognising it, trying to get help for it, and dealing with it on a day-to-day basis. And I just thought, this person's changed so much. He's a broken man. And whether it was grabbing hold of me in the middle of the night, or he'd be on the bed, at the end of the bed, shooting his rifle.
Pretend.
In his sleep. He didn't know what he was doing. And I thought, oh, this is just something's wrong. Something's really wrong.
Dale Leach with his wife, Laura.
That incident, you know, and you being in that situation and that accident changed your life forever and continues to change your life. It upsets me because obviously it happened to my husband. I wish I could go back and just be there and say, turn left, not right, or I could say selfishly that I wish it had happened to somebody else, you know, which is I know is a really terrible thing to say, I know that, but I do wish I would go back and I would change it.
They walk hand in hand beside the sea. Dale's using a cane.
Like, it took a lot of your friends, didn't it? And it, and then even the people that went, they didn't come back the same, did they? We know quite a lot of people, close friends, that perhaps went out as someone and came back someone completely different.
I am not the person that I was before. I'm still trying to figure out if I have PTSD or whether it's part of my head injuries. There's something gone, there's something missing, there's a hole. But I feel lucky to have been a part of everything. I feel like I have done my part.
Over the years, following that tour, everything came to head. I had a catastrophic breakdown. The therapy lasted 9 months. I'm glad it happened, because if it didn't, that breakdown would still be chasing me to this day.
Stephen sitting on a tall rock, then John walking his dog.
So I think he got diagnosed with a PTSD in 2012.
I did EMDR therapy, and that was incredible. It helped so much, and, you know, it was so... I cried, like I've never cried before, and got angry, and the emotion would be less than the first time I felt it. And then we would do it again, then it would be less again. I want to be okay all the time, you know, and that's not life. People have shit days, people have bad days, but I'm a lot wiser now than I was 10 years ago.
Yeah, I've got so much respect for him, which I don't ever tell him. It makes us a bit more special as a couple because of everything that we've been through together and survived.
Yeah.
Life is real as it is. It's, you know, it's not Disneyland.
August 2021, 7 years after the withdrawal of British troops, the Taliban regained control of Afghanistan, including Helmand province.
Taliban fighters enter the presidential palace in Kabul as they retake the Afghan capital 20 years after being forced from power. Their arrival sparks an exodus from the city as Afghans head towards the border and the president flees the country.
I remember the day Kabul fell.
Men running while crouched and transport helicopters taking off over the city.
What was it all for? All those lives that are lost.
Crowds on the grass outside an airport.
It was all taken away.
That's actually the sand from Afghanistan. Dane felt they were really making a difference, a big difference, and he felt really proud of what they were achieving. But when I think back now, was it all worth it? After it's gone back to what it was, all the hard work that these lads have put in, for what? You know?
Deborah Morris holding a small vial of sand, then Dale Leach.
Was it worth it?
Probably not. But it's just a job you sign up to do.
The reasons why we're there, you know, you could sit here all day and debate about it, and that's nothing to do with me. That's getting into politics. This is not about that.
We went there following the mission, the political mission, and we did our part in 2009, and I'm proud of what I did during my time in Afghanistan.
You know, like, they was fucking starting to build schools, and they was fucking... The women would be with their husbands out in the street. Obviously, they covered up, but, you know, that wouldn't happen with the Taliban about. It wouldn't. So I think we did definitely made an impact in our sense.
That tour for me reminded me how much I loved him and who's important in my life. And I'm so grateful that you're sat here with me now.
Yeah.
You know, with no ill effects. That's what that 7 months was. Hideous, but we got through it and we're okay.
You've come out the other side.
Yeah.
I was gutted to leave, so I'd go back tomorrow if I could. I'd do it all again tomorrow, even though what I've been through, if I knew that could happen again, I think I'd still do it. I'd do it all again.
I miss it, you know? It's like a part of you's missing. Because that was the worst time of my life and the best time as well.
What was the best things about it?
Doing the job I wanted to do the whole of my life. And the worst part of it is fucking nearly dying. So... But I'd go back and do it all over again.
Would you?
Yeah.
You get that feel of being part of a team. It's a brotherhood. You have that connection. And that bond stays strong for a lifetime.
In memory of those who lost their lives while serving in the Welsh Guards battle group in summer 2009, Toby Fasfus, Mark Everson, Rupert Thornlow, Dane Elson, John Brackpool, Papal Shah, Sean Birchall, Joshua Hammond, Christopher King, Ahmed Papal.
Details of organisations offering information and support with mental health or self-harm are available at the BBC Action Line website, or you can call for free at any time to hear recorded information on 08000 155 998.